You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
So it's me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm joined today with my guest, Tim King, consultant with Southwest Consulting. How are you doing today, Tim?
Doing well. Yourself?
So you and I met. Now, was it originally ACA or Kansas City B2B?
B2B first.
B2B first. Okay, fantastic. And what stuck out to me about you is, well, you balance friendly and approachable while also being a little bit reserved, warm, I know with you, it's going to be a deeper conversation about things. It's not going to be just, you're not going to talk my ear off about the weather. And I think that ties in pretty well with what you do, which is, if I get that right, it's a decent bit of sales consulting. I know you and I have sit on a one-on-one, and you've even kind of helped me think through in detail some of the different aspects of what I'm going through.
Yep, I would say that is a fair assessment. I am by nature an innovator. I like to do things differently. So when we think about networking and like the B2B, for example, I will almost stand back and observe first, unless there's somebody there I immediately know. And if it is, then I'll seek that person out in order to kind of, you know, propel myself to bounce around the room. But if I don't know somebody, I'll kind of sit back and observe, and then I'll almost like a sniper, pick off the people that I'm like, that sounds like an interesting conversation, or that person likes an interesting talk to because of way they're dressed or manners or whatever. And I'll just kind of, you know, kind of pick off three or four people that I'm like, I'm curious, which is how I kind of engaged with you.
Yeah. No, I like that approach. I relate to it as well. Because, you know, I mean, for me, I'll end up talking to a few folks, but typically one of them is a much longer conversation, right? And it's normally, what's interesting is it's normally that person that's like more willing to open up, go deep on the things that are interesting and in their life. And so anyway, a side item that I didn't even really fully think of till now, but it's why the podcast is so fun, right? Because we get to engage in as interesting individuals in an interesting conversation and kind of go into deep on the stuff that makes you, Tim, interesting. So tell me in a little bit more detail, in your words, what are you doing currently with Southwest Consulting?
Sure. So Southwestern Consulting is one portion of the Southwestern family of companies. So born in 1870 was the Southwestern Advantage Company that kind of went out and did direct sales. You know, that point in time, of course, not a lot of you know, cell phones and things. So a lot of door-to-door and direct sales as kind of a United States pioneer in that industry. Eventually, people started asking us to say, how do you do that, right? One of the companies as a very well-known financial advisory company, born in the 1920s, you probably figure out who it is. But they came to us and said, how do you do that so well? And we kind of started teaching them. And then over the course of time, in 2007, the Southwestern consulting side was born, where we primarily do sales and leadership training, one-on-one coaching, and then consulting, because you can kind of throw everything into that bag of tricks when you say consulting. So primarily what I do is I like to work with, you know, small business owners, sales teams, to try to help either the leader or the teammate figure out how to be better at their job. Whether that is, you know, trying to help them get unstuck from an obstacle, you know, or, hey, what's your vision? Why is it you're doing what you're doing? Or even something as simple as, where do you want to go? Okay, now let's try to backwards figure out how you're going to get there. So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, not to sell it short, it's not complicated, but we all need that somebody in our lives to ask us those questions and help us get there. And hopefully I can fulfill that role for folks.
Yeah. So to kind of turn back the clock a little bit from where you're at now, and let's go back to kind of that high school. So, right, you're in a Kansas City local, correct?
That's correct.
So, kind of let's start with the high school period, high school, college period. Where do you find yourself geographically, and what's kind of your first dream?
High school. So, you know, I'm fortunate to go to a small enough school where I could be a three-sport athlete and, you know, be heavily involved in things and, you know, sing in the choir and all those kinds of good things. Got decent grades, but that was, my mom was a nurse. Dad was in sales and sales training. And so I saw a lot of those things in my life. And a lot of just relationships that they had with close friends where they had a bridge club that came over and played and some of that kind of thing. So that's kind of helped to round out my personality very, very well. That to say that through that experience, I started thinking about, okay, to your point, what I want to do, you know, when I grow up, right? I knew college was probably in my future. I was, you know, very heavily, not pushed, but, what's the word for it? Not pushed, but, presented to me as a good option. Of course, in 1990, that was a still a fairly inexpensive option as things go. And I was trying to figure out, okay, what do I want to do? You know, I really involved like the sporting and like health stuff. So I thought, oh, I'll be a coach and a trainer somewhere, you know? And then as I got a little older and my dad was talking about his college career and how he eventually wanted to be a sportscaster, I'm like, well, that sounds like fun too. Maybe I'll do something like that. Which eventually then, you know, led me off to college where I was looking at being like an occupational or a, more importantly, a physical therapist. So that would get me into that sporting side and working with people that, you know, potentially had sports injuries. But then my, back secondary, my minor was mass communications and where I thought, hey, I'll do something in broadcasting. And then maybe someday down the road, I'll figure out a way to marry, physical therapy and broadcasting together. Plans quickly changed, transferred colleges a couple times. Eventually, you know, found my future bride and, or she found me one way or the other and, decided to get married. And so then when you get out of college, you're like, okay, now what? I did end up getting a broadcasting degree from Northwest Missouri State with a minor in health education. So I still kind of played in those two realms, just backwards, not exactly what I intended, but sometimes getting a degree is better than you know, floundering for 8, 10, 12 years. But that led me to my first sales job right out of college, where they handed me a Yellow Pages at a radio station and said, here's the Kansas City Metro, go get them. After about 2 weeks of training. First, other than, you know, part-time work here or there, Best Buy or whatever, first real experience with sales. That was a floundering moment. Not having a process, not having a system, not having somebody there to hold you accountable, you know, all those things, that lasted for about 6 months before I decided that I needed to find more regular employment and or more regular income.
Well, and that, so that would have been B2B, right? And it would, it, you're a hunter at that point, definitely, compared to anything you would have had at Best Buy would have been, you would have been a gatherer, right? I mean, yeah. I guess by definition there.
Yeah.
Or farmer.
Yeah.
Depending on how you want to call it.
And what's interesting is that when I first started, I didn't realize this until later, so I'll tie this in later, but that's when I first realized that as competitive I was and playing sports and running and everything else, I didn't have that killer mentality that some people had. I wasn't the kind of person that wanted to go out and hear 100 no's to get one yes. My psyche does not enjoy that experience, right? And so it's later in life that I've learned, you know, how to understand the difference and manage that. But anyway, that was one of the first aha moments in my life, was like, this is not fun. I don't enjoy this. I'd rather go work for the man than you know, beat my head against a brick wall and not enjoy this process.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. So you made it about 6 months at that. Very difficult 6 months, because you probably, did you land a single account in the 6 months time?
I think I had three.
Okay. All right. Three. That had to have been pretty exciting though, those moments.
I mean, yeah, but they were, the sad thing is that in that industry, if you don't have a bar, restaurant, or automotive dealership, you don't make any money. And so the three I landed were like a chiropractor's office, you know, somebody that just basically randomly did advertising. So it was enough to say that I had three accounts, but it wasn't enough to say that I had an income.
Oh, wow. Okay. Interesting. Wow. Oof. Oof. So yeah, that's like a false win almost. Yeah. Kinda.
Yeah. Now think about this. Newly married, wanting to buy a house. Yeah. My wife is a second year teacher, you know, so, Timbo here has got to earn some income. Otherwise, we're not going to have much of a place to live.
That's six depressing months. Yeah. That's, because, you know, you're questioning yourself at that point, right? You're questioning your motives and the direction you're going and if it's ever going to take off or go anywhere or anything's going to happen.
Yeah.
And the few times you do manage to get a win, they don't come with anything of substance.
Well, and two, you know, sometimes you learn very early on with an experience like that how to evaluate when you've been sold. So when you go for a job interview and somebody says, all these things are awesome, let's promise you the world. And you realize that most of those promises are half-hearted and empty. So then you have to really start understanding, okay, the world, you know, going from a college student and living under mom and dad's roof to going to be a real adult is like, oh man, this world kind of sucks sometimes.
Well, this would be fun to talk about because I kind of, it's an interesting contrast. So I'm experienced with one of my older brothers where they're used car salesmen and he recounts selling his first car. And I think back on his manager and this to me just seems genius. I mean, if this manager even went extra heavy, he knew what he was doing. You know, my brother comes in, younger guy at the time, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. He sold his first car, right? His first sale. And the manager goes, good job. You just made a grand or whatever he made, whatever commission was, right? In 15 minutes, right? And then he hands him the check right there, like very instant gratification, you know, and for the right salesman, right? You're triggering that. You're like, oh, if you've got that person that looks for that stimulus, which is all of us really, who doesn't like confirmation that they're doing the right thing? And you have a manager that is willing to, that is smart enough to know to promote that quickly versus, and I'm not saying, maybe it was just the system, I get it, but also like you would have kind of hoped in another sense, maybe they would have broke the rules for that first sale, so to speak, to help.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the genius in that is it's exactly that. It's for people that need instant gratification instead of delayed gratification and knowing that that personality exists, then you have to understand who is it that needs that, right? You know, and so as a manager, it really speaks to being able to read the personalities of your people, being able to understand the personalities of your team and understanding that, you know, one size doesn't always fit all. Sure, you can do certain things, systems and processes that may fit the team very well. However, through what we call PCs, personal conferences, you can quickly figure out what each individual needs based on their personality style, you know, based on how they just communicate with you, right? And having that open line of communication, sometimes, you know, those that need something different will generally tell you if you give them the opportunity.
Yeah, you're right. And it's an interesting thing, right? Because I relate to my brother in that instant gratification, but I've talked to other sales professionals that, you know, I asked them how they got started, how they got to where they're at. And they're like, they have the foresight to, you know, I got hired on at a job and my goal for my first year was to replace my salary. To earn so much in commissions that it replaced my salary and thus also justified my base pay because I was making my base pay in commission. And it's to have that foresight. I mean, I think everybody, when pulled back and asked, knows that, like, hey, you've got to sell or you're not going to be able to keep your position, right? But for me personally, you would have to ask me that. In a younger me going into my first sales position, you would have to go out of my way to, like, address me, because I'm more of that instant gratification. Like, I'm not thinking 6 months, a year ahead necessarily. I'm thinking, you know, where's that next check at?
Yeah. Yeah. And some people, you know, aren't money motivated, you know, so for some people, it's not the paycheck,
right?
You know, it's the stability the paycheck brings, right? It's the hours, you know, if I can work 40 hours a week and make this much money, that's fine by me, versus working 60 and making that much more. You know, those are again, just understanding your people and how they operate.
Yeah, that's good. So you decide 6 months in with a couple of closed deals that don't net any commissions, new marriage and hope for a home, you got to make a shift. What's that shift look like? What was the planning to that shift look like?
Well, since you and I have met in networking, you'll love this side of it, right? So I use my network to try to find my next gig. A fellow who's one of my best friends today, he was working for a company that made industrial electric motors in Riverside. His first job out of college? I think so, first job out of college. And he got hired, you know, as the office manager, which really meant, you know, in a company of let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about less than 10 people, jack of all trades, master of none, right? Clean toilets, mop floors, but also then handle customer service and big orders and things like that, right? All the things. So he hires me as an inside salesperson. Again, now I'm like, dang it, sales. All right, fine. But, you know, it's really just customer service, you know, helping people kind of figure out what they need, what they don't need, those kind of things. And I was, you know, again, because I'm talkative, because I'm personable, all those things, easy to talk to at times, that was a natural fit for me. Gosh, I don't know how long I was in that position, but eventually the warehouse had lost their manager, so I got sent out to become the warehouse manager. And then I kind of got the operational bug. You know, I had, you know, a team of one or two usually working for me and run a forklift, which I enjoyed the activity side of it. But also, too, you know, we always got our stuff done generally before it needed to be done. We were efficient and got things done. And that was kind of a lot of fun, just, you know, being out there and kind of being in charge or being a team, part of a team, same time. So that was job number two, and probably still today, if I could still be doing that today, that would be a lot of fun. And I'm sure it would probably look more like, you know, the director of something at a company if I would have stayed in that side of the house, so to speak. But operations, that's kind of when I started really liking that side of the business.
Okay. Yeah, so you enjoyed managing people and formulating the forming the operational flow. Can you kind of tell me of an example of something you tweaked? Because that's where my mind goes. Like you probably did this a lot, but one in particular that, like, jumps out at you where you're like, what if we do it this way instead of that way?
Yeah. I mean, we use a system that was FIFO, first in, first out. No, everybody that's ever been in logistics has heard that term at some point. So that system was great, but our racking system in the warehouse was incredibly disorganized. And it first in, first out wasn't always followed. For lack of a better term, because of somebody's poor time management before me, it was grab the first available, not the first in. So when we went and did inventory, it was like, we can't find anything. Because it's so chaotically organized, it's not first in, first out. So just really, truly leaning into that and implementing that process And getting the warehouse organized made, yeah, it took a little time, but that time spent early on resulted in time savings where, yeah, if I had two people working with me in the warehouse, myself and two others, we were done by noon, 1 o'clock, unless something came in. You know, it was so much more efficient. And that's kind of, you know, where I started learning about time management, learning about efficiency.
That's cool. So you said you didn't know how long you were there. What was kind of the next transition? What forced the transition? Or was there something that forced the transition?
2 years, 3 years. I just, you know, because I'm kind of an innovator, I get bored with things. And the next position in that company, since it was a small company, was going to be, I mean, the office manager, maybe? I mean, I don't know where I would have gone, right?
Right.
Outside sales, didn't really want to do that. And after that, it was the owner, you know? And the owner's still a friend of mine today. So I'm like, well, I'm not going to get his job. So, yeah, I went to work at Citibank. I took that knowledge of using the phone and that kind of stuff. And I also knew, too, that Citibank kind of offered a program to help offset college tuition. So yeah. I went to work in all stage collections. In Citibank, which if I'd have known what I know now, I probably should have gone into customer service side instead of the collection side, but hindsight's 2020. But I really went there. One, it was a little more money, a lot more benefits. It was an opportunity to think about a master's degree. So I worked there listening to people tell me why they couldn't pay their bills and me trying to sell them on paying their bills one way or another, which does not fit my personality at all. Cause it's almost like some people really were competitive at it. And I felt like it was begging for money, you know? So that wasn't as much fun for me, but I knew that the end result was getting there and getting my master's. So that was kind of, I eventually got into Baker University and got a master's in business administration and kind of focused on strategic planning, kind of going back to that operational side again.
So tell me more about the so how long were you in the collections thing again?
Again, about 2 years.
About 2 years.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
I had to be there
that.
For about 6 months before I was eligible for the tuition reimbursement.
Okay.
And so as soon as I finished my degree, that was enough of Citibank and collections for me.
Well, collections, yeah, that has to be its own interesting sort of thing for sure. That had to get you a little bit jaded listening to
it. Certainly did not. It certainly added to my cynicism.
Yeah. And I don't know if you and I have talked about this or not, but I had a partnership at some point in there. And prior to the partnership, I had never received a collections call. The concept was just like so foreign to me. And then in the partnership, I received collections calls all the time. It was kind of interesting. I would answer them all. I think 9 out of 10 of them were more impressed that I picked up the phone. They're like, I've been trying for the last like 6 months and you actually picked up the phone. So it put me in a good position with them because it's, you know, my response was typically, right. Well, my response was typically, well, I owe you money. So it seems to me like the least I could do is pick up the phone. I mean, if you call me, you know, 10 times a day, that might be different. But if you're going to check in with me once a week, it seemed to me like the least I could do is pick up that phone. I'm not saying I can pay you. And then sometimes that would put them off a little bit because it's like, I mean, I'm being honest, man. I'll pick up the phone for you. I'm just not saying I can pay you. Once or twice, they'd get really upset and threaten legal stuff, which was annoying because it was like, annoying is not even the right word. It was, I think they thought I was lying to them, which I could completely understand, but it's like, I'm being as truthful as it, you know, it's like, there's two things I'm going to be to you. I'm going to pick up the phone. I'm going to be truthful. And if I could pay you and get you to go away, that would be number one on my list. But, since I can't, and then some of them would, oh, we're going to sue you. And I was like, well, I don't know how you'll get any more money out of that than if you just wait. And so
a bunch of legal fees, all you'll get out of that.
Yeah, it was an ordeal, but it was a humbling ordeal because it, you know, I was like, I'd never had anything like that. And so I'm always kind of fascinated a little bit for the other end of that as a result, because I've heard, you know, my partner just wouldn't pick up the phone. And then when he did pick up the phone, it was a completely different conversation. And I've overheard other people pick up the phone and kind of their conversations. And I think maybe once you've had them, you're more in tune to, like, I mean, shoot, I could hear that conversation from across the hall, right? It doesn't, it's not like it's a super cryptic conversation. I don't think if you've ever had one before, you might be able to pick up on what it is. But when you're, it's like, you know, hey, I'll have the money for you or whatever it is, right? And so I don't know. And then I worked in a call center for a little bit and help desk. So, and that call center jaded the heck out of me because it was your typical internet. Have you unplugged it and plugged it back in? And people would lie to me just trying to help them fix their internet. So I'm curious if there's a particular horror story that you remember. A very difficult conversation, or if it's just
I have done my best to try to subdue most of those memories. Yeah, because that's, I mean, until today.
Yes.
As a coach, one of the things we talk about is call aversion, right? I still have it today. It's like PTSD for calling, right? I just don't like calling people other than, that's not true. I love calling people and having a conversation.
Sure.
I hate calling people to ask for business. Sounds counterintuitive, sure. but that's part of where that came from, you know. And I have to really, really work hard to overcome that little glitch in my system. But there's ways, just a matter of, and that's why, you know, I do a lot of networking and those kind of things. It's ways to overcome that and create more warm leads, referrals, blah blah. But anyway. So one of the things that I remember very distinctly was, and I can't remember if it was a man or woman that was talking to me. It's been too long ago. I mean, 20 something years ago. But they were they were 6 months behind, and we're talking tens of thousands of dollars. And, you know, we're threatening them with sending them off to a collection agency and all the things. And this person on the other end was like, well, what can I pay you? I'm like, basically, you know, how much you got? And they're like, well, I'm like, you know, $10. I'm like, well, if you pay $10, what are you not doing? Well, and I was like, you still got food, you still got lights, you still got shelter. Yep. But you can pay $10. And they're like, yep. I'm like, now, can you pay $10 every week? Yeah, I can do that. And it was one of those little situations where it was like, it was so rewarding for that person to actually hear somebody ask, well, what can you do? Versus just beating them over the head with, you owe $50,000 or $30,000 or whatever it was. Right? And just to have that little, like, they're at the end of the call, they're like, thank you. I really appreciate that. I'm like, sure, I didn't do nothing. You know, I didn't really help you. I probably put you in a worse spot because you're paying $40 a month you didn't have to begin with. But you thought that was big help, and it made you feel better. If nothing else, maybe that's the first step towards whatever's next to get you on the right path to being able to afford to pay your bills, which I think. But anyway, that was one little story I very, very, very vaguely remember, because I remember that feeling of, you can pay $10 a month or $10 a week. Okay, cool. And you're thanking me? Crazy.
Well, that's the one thing I kind of appreciated about, because I've been in some facilities too when those agents were taking the calls and in the collections facilities. And it's interesting too, that is kind of how some of them posture. Like you, it's you know, it's we're here to help. And I mean, you are, it's a debt that's owed, and it's like you do have to fulfill it, and it's better on everybody if you do. Those are just facts. And right. So now it's kind of like, all right, well, clearly we need to help you a little bit to some end. What does that look like? What does that process look like for you?
Yeah. Kind of speaks to that, you know, servant sales or servant leadership mentality.
Yeah.
You know, the older I've gotten, the more I've heard about that and read some books on it. I really, that's how I try and embrace sales and leadership is, you know, how can I help?
Yeah.
You know, what skills do I have that I can utilize to help you? What connections do I have that I can utilize to help you? Right. And with the theory of, hey, some people are going to be takers, some people are going to be givers. And I feel like the more that I can give and help people, you know, whether it just makes me feel good or whether they're going to pay me for some service, something that I can do later on the road, that's, you know, another story. But kind of that's the kind of mentality.
No, you're right. And it's you need to give to find out which is which, you know? So, yeah.
And unfortunately, sometimes you got to make, you know, tough choices. Those people that just take, sometimes that's the ones you have to be like, you look, I can help you, but, you know, I can't help you for free. I've been doing that. Now we're at the point where now it needs to be transactional versus just me helping you to feel good. Right.
Right.
So there's some of that in the back of my head too. It's like, when do you make that call out? But
well, it's an interesting, okay. So to that end, there's a phenomenon that, you know, it's like, and me and my friends almost intuitively, they've got books and stuff they can actually attribute it to, but like a scarcity mentality versus an abundance mentality.
Yeah.
Right. And what's interesting is in my opinion, the scarcity mentality, also simultaneously more often than not, potentially the taker, is upsettingly enough. And this isn't universal, but it does seem pretty often that those are the ones that aren't necessarily going to get the most out of what they've received.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. To
speak to that point, I mean, yeah, it usually, and again, let's go back to abundance, right?
Yeah.
And just in sales, when your pipeline's full and you got more clients to do with, yeah, you're typically running around like a chicken with your head cut off trying to figure out how do I take care of all these people. But you're not worried about tomorrow.
Yeah.
You're just worried about surviving today, right? When you're on the other side of that and you're in that scarcity mentality, you've got lots of time to worry about tomorrow. And sometimes that worrying about tomorrow can paralyze what you do today.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, yeah, 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 yeah. There's a lot there because it's, and I even mean from, it's interesting because it, you know, I think we've all been in that position where we've needed help. I know I sure have. I mean, I basically recounted some of it for you. Uh-huh. And what's crazy is like, I remember needing so much help. I basically tag teamed who I called to avoid draining any particular one person. So I'm not going to say I wasn't definitely didn't have a good year where I felt like a leech, whether or not I was one. I definitely felt like one, or an energy vampire, whatever you want to call it. And it's like, on one hand, it's like, but I flipped it around. I don't know if that was me or the grace of God or whatever you want to call it. But there are some people in some businesses where it's upsetting and it's difficult because it's like, will they turn it around? Right. And those are the ones that, like, you know, it's like a heartthrob story. And it's, you know, you look at it and it's like, I mean, I really feel for you. And yet, you know, you try to help. Ideally, they ask for help. You try to help. But then it's like, where's the cutoff? And then where do they? And this is difficult for me, too, because, you know, any good business book you read, right, is like, or any success story. It happened on the other end of like, I just pushed through for 3 years and then that third year and that thing happened and that, right? Yeah.
Just miraculously broke through, right?
Yeah. And then, but how many stories along the way do we not hear where it's like, oh man, are you kidding? I kept it for 10 years. I kept it for 15 years. I kept it for 20 years. And it's anyway. There's a lot there. I wish I knew exactly what it was I'm asking. It's just something I always pay attention to because I think it's a slight nerve thing for me. It's like, you know, on one hand, I need to blindly continue on optimistically. That's how I wake up tomorrow. On the other hand, That's also how a lot of people maybe haven't yet woken up to the notion that the newspaper is going away, right?
Sure. Yep.
That might be an example of like an industry that's still, you know, Blockbuster had the opportunity to buy Netflix and they didn't. And they didn't innovate. You know, they had all these stores and now they have one. And so that's like the ideal example of somebody that like, you know, we're just going to plow forward. You're going to keep going. It's like, well, things are way different than they were last year. It's okay. We're in a recession. We're just going to plow forward. We're going to keep going. Well, they're way different this year than it's, yeah, but the, you know, the market's going to turn around and Netflix is going to be bankrupt tomorrow. You know, whatever they told themselves, right? When in reality, it's like, make a change.
But change is hard, number one. Number two, now put yourself in the CEOs or the upper management of Blockbuster, right? If we tell all of our employees that are, you know, feeding themselves on their wages that all of this stuff is going online and that you may no longer have a job, how incredibly hard would that have been for the manager of that store, let alone that regional manager, let alone the CEO of the company, right? Now, that said, you no reason you couldn't have taken and had some sort of hybrid model for a while that transition happened, where people would naturally leave because they were like, hey, this thing will be around forever, I got to go find something else to do, you know, or, hey, I need to know how to adapt and what education I've got to get in order so that way I can stay with the company and do this other thing. What does that look like? Right? Good people will find a way to adapt and you know, move forward. Other good people will be like, okay, the adaption is not my strong suit, so I need to go find another job, whether it's a clerk at a grocery store, right? But yeah, put yourself in that CEO's shoes, like, okay, we've built this thing and it's rocking and rolling. It is, I mean, Family Video, gone out of business, and all these things, right? All these stores. Heck, grocery stores used to carry a whole selection of VHS tapes or whatever it was. DVDs.
Yeah.
Yeah, DVDs.
All the above.
All the above. Whatever we're talking about.
I think they had VHSs for a stint for sure, too. So, yeah, I agree.
My Country Mart store in Platte City certainly did, right?
Yeah.
You know, go in there, and that was a Friday or Saturday night. It was pizza and a movie at the house,
yeah,
right? So, heck yeah. But all those things had to move, change, and adapt. Blockbuster didn't. And so now they're not around. Hard choices had to be made. And they made a hard choice to continue the path that they thought was going to be a winner. And they were wrong.
I think I'm having a moment. I think that's the difference. The difference is that person that looks at, we all have something we can improve, we could grow. We have a problem. There's a problem in your life and my life that we need to fix or overcome. And perhaps the difference is looking for that. Because if you listen to this is apparently fresh in my head and very relevant to what we're talking about. The Blockbuster, they even talk about, the Netflix guy, he was like, well, you have to think about it. They had all these stores and the online thing was directly in competition. He's like, and they kind of tried that. But the problem was that they didn't go all in on it because it wasn't the main thing that had historically worked. And now they're doing this other thing in competition with their stores to keep up with Netflix, but they are not mainlining it because it wasn't their main thing. And so
I got to interrupt you for a second, because this is, if you think about this, think about Amazon, okay? Amazon really started as a book company, a distribution company.
Yes.
What did Blockbuster have? Each location could have been its own little distribution company.
Yeah.
They could have. And what did Netflix do? They started with a monthly subscription. I was a member.
Yeah.
You know,
I remember one, back when the DVDs, right? Showed up in, yeah, the mail.
Yeah. You get one a month, or for a different subscription, you get three a month or whatever it is, or one a week or whatever it is. Or one at a time. I can't remember, yeah, anymore, but Blockbuster could have easily, with all the distribution points they had that model.
Well, they the Netflix guy said, because they kind of started that for a stint or came close to it, and he said that would have destroyed us. He's like, because
they were too late.
Yeah. Yeah, that's yes, yes.
So if you go back to Amazon, Amazon started out as a distribution company for books and then incorporate all the other stuff.
Yeah.
And is what it is today, right? Distribution logistics, that's how they basically make their money. So, you know, or Amazon does. Netflix, kind of the same thing. Blockbuster didn't change and adapt from a retail B2B to a distribution company, and therefore they're no longer here. It's an interesting parallel if you think about the three of those two things, the three companies together, and the timing especially.
Well, and it's nice to, so let's kind of loop around, right? Because if Blockbuster, this multi-million dollar easy, I don't know if they hit the full billion, but they, you know, they it was a lot. It was a big company. If they can't figure out how to pivot, you know, we have these small single, double, you know, 5-person, 10-person firms, talking recently to a 100-person firm that blew up over COVID. Now they're two now, right? It shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't be, we don't need it for anybody out there that is struggling. We don't need to view it as like a self-damning, like if Blockbuster with all their advisors and their consultants and their struggle to make the pivot, it's okay. That's the moral of the story. It's okay.
It is. It also, I think the bigger the company, the harder it is to pivot. That's another key takeaway, I think, from this too, right? Netflix, Upstart, innovate. Amazon was an upstart, innovate. Blockbuster was a giant and found it hard to pivot, partly because my guess is if there was a case study done on Blockbuster, I bet it involves something along the lines of too many people that they couldn't all agree on the right decision. And so they probably just agreed on no decision at all.
What I think you have to be willing to take, Netflix, this is a good example. I think you have to be willing to take massive risks, even as you grow. Because they had this online platform all of a sudden, and you may remember you're getting the DVDs. But then they made a jump all of a sudden to not do the DVDs. And I remember thinking, wow, because they weren't at the level of production that they had now. These were B-grade movies with an occasional A-liner that I don't know how they got, maybe from 5 years ago or whatever, right?
Right.
And I used to be able to get these Hollywood mainstream DVDs to now only consume B-plus quality live stream. Uh-huh. And what was interesting, and I remember for me, the convenience of it all, I was willing to put up with lesser quality movies. And then when I got a mainline, right, obviously it was like Friday night, I got the same value, the same Friday night movie night for the one mainliner they had for that week or whatever, that month or however long. But that was such a jump on their part.
Yeah. Yeah. And how do you, I mean, I guess part of it is too, because you already had a structure community, you know, a subscription model, you knew how much risk of loss you could take before it would be too much. Right. To go from all the physical that was more expensive than the digital, how much risk of loss could you handle? In other words, how many subscribers would be out the door? And again, think about it too, there was a transition period between getting a physical, you know, DVD in the mail that you could play, that was usually some of your higher grade titles at the time, to online streaming only, right? And I was not a member long enough to understand that full transition because I wasn't around to be part of it. You know, it wasn't until it was fully streaming that I came back around to Netflix.
Yeah.
You know, and it was really when it's been the last 7 years you know, getting rid of DirecTV and, you know, going to YouTube TV and then the streaming service to augment that, right? Or add to that. You know, that's when I've fully become understanding of how all that works now. But I wasn't part of that transition to understand when was that shift when they just finally cut the cord, so to speak, and went fully streaming.
Yeah. Sorry for the random bunny trail, and I'm trying to remember to loop back fully. I know we were talking about
Citibank.
Yeah, Citibank and collections, and I think what it was difficult conversations and understanding when to pivot. I don't know how we got pivot into and because it was a thing off a thing, but
yeah. And it was, I was working at Citibank, and the big thing there was I was there for a purpose to get that degree. And then once I got mm-hmm. that master's degree, okay, now it's time to pivot and move on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're exactly right. So you got that master's degree, right? And you, uh-huh. you realize you're back into sales, which you're making a really good argument that everything is sales. So you, cause or, I mean, if
remind me to tell you a story about that.
You're welcome tell you to now. Or just, yeah.
So you and I have been at mutual or networking events together. This is one of the ones yeah. that was downtown at Patton and Ryan. A lady walks up to me. Hi, my name's so-and-so. Hi, nice to meet you. I'm like, what do you do? She says, marketing. I'm like, perfect. She tells me about her marketing jobs like that. I said, at the end, I said, so you're in sales. And she looks at me and she goes, no, I'm in marketing. I'm like, okay. So we continue the conversation. I'm like, tell me about a time when you had a tough conversation with your client where you had to kind of convince them to go a certain route, or they asked you to make changes and then you had to go back in and represent. And she's like, she looked at me and she goes, kind of, you know, scowled, doggone it, I'm in sales. I'm like, yeah, you had to listen to their objections. You yeah. had to represent and reclose.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether you're in a presentation with a client or whether you're in a conversation like this. You know, eventually one of us is going to have objections somewhere. One of us may have to try to convince the other to do something that we may not necessarily thought of before or didn't think about that way. It's all just sales.
Right. I mean, it can literally be applied to our opinion. So you said objection. For some reason, my mind went straight to like an opinion on Lord of the Rings. Like, oh, maybe I like Lord of the Rings better than Star Wars. And, you know, we got, and I, but I'm trying to convince you that they're really the same thing. We're just you know, what? So for the audio only folks, what did the mug say again here? Okay. We've got Spaceballs. Fantastic. May the Schwartz be with you. Excellent. 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 Hi there. I got to be careful here because I'm going to get crucified by so many people. So the first like 30 minutes of that movie, absolutely love the ludicrous speed, the Darth helmet or whatever. I wasn't as big a fan of the rest of the movie for some reason. I don't know. I just kind of went off the rails. Too many pithy tropes or something. I typically love his movies. Just uh-huh. for that one in particular, I was kind of like, eh.
Yep.
I said it. Eh.
I understand. Hey, you know what? The more I watch it, and which I've watched it, I mean, I can't count how many times. And it's been long enough ago that I have to, my memory works to where I don't like, I've got a friend of mine that he remembers details about movies and things. I'm like, do that. I don't have enough space in my brain or it's not, you know, to work that way, but I'll remember some odd statistic. Give me a
there
number
you go.
And I'll probably remember that, but give me a line from a movie. Yeah. Even though I've seen it 100 times, I still can't recount all the lines.
I get it. So, what'd you transition towards again out of Citibank?
A couple of just odd things along the way, you know, random, hey, I'm going to try and sell fire alarms. I'm going to try to do this and do that. Just random stuff that I was at a point where I didn't want to be in sales I didn't want to deal with people. You know, it really kind of soured me on people. But I had this master's degree now, and I was like, how am I going to use this thing? And started just having random conversations with a neighbor who owned his own little two-way radio company, and end up going to work for them as a basically sales and marketing manager, you know, where I kind of, it was, I mean, it's me and him, you know, occasionally his wife was doing some social media or, you know, marketing stuff. But for the most part, it was us trying to figure out, you know, this is early days before WordPress was a thing, and trying to figure out how to advertise and put stuff online and create our own little hodgepodge of a website, and, you know, find ways to generate leads and tell people how we did stuff and what we did. And that was, you know, a couple of years of in the trenches, grassroots understanding what the internet was and sales and marketing on the internet and how all that would or could work. So I felt like I finally got to use a little bit of my degree, even though it didn't have anything to it with necessarily the MBA side of it. It was operations. It was creating SOPs. It was creating systems to try to help things grow. Plus, I also decided to start a couple of different businesses of my own, where I was making some mountain bike wheels because I was big into mountain biking and had the mechanical ability to lace things up and make them work right. And also, too, found the love of home brewing. So I had a little homebrew supply store out of the house and sold some homebrew supplies to even folks that today are well known in Kansas City. Right. So.
That's cool. Yeah. Brewing's a fun pastime. I think we've talked about this a little bit. I've done some mead brewing a little bit. It's also really interesting. This still kind of baffles my mind. I mean, maybe it's so obvious, but I didn't know anything about it. You know, the difference between a beer and a hard liquor is typically based. I mean, obviously there's more to it, but it's a lot of the distilling. The distilling it is where, so like the difference between a wine and a cognac is distilling it into a harder alcohol.
Yeah, or the fermentation process is the one of the first steps in making a distilled spirit, versus the fermentation process is the last step in making a beer. Because basically what they distilled in is what they call high beer or high wine, depending on the ingredients. And that's how you end up with the distilled spirit.
Yeah. Which is a cognac, I believe, in the case of wine. Okay. That sounded like a lot of fun. What had you settle on? How many more hops are we at to where you're at now? What brought you to here?
Well, so the next two are the most important. So I worked for motorcycle closeouts in Smithville. Most of what they did was online. They bought stuff at super discounts and then sold online at basically, you know, 40 to 60% off. And I was customer service for them and had a decent voice in the day-to-day operations and some of those kind of things. So I really enjoyed, you know, that aspect and kind of, again, getting to use my brain to do some things versus just, you know, talking to people on the phone and what have you. But the next step was Missouri Farm Bureau. I became a insurance agent for Farm Bureau. A friend of mine recruited me there. The lady who actually was my sales trainer is who eventually recruited me to Southwestern Consulting.
Gotcha.
So I was there for a couple of years and learned
back
again
at
more
full on sales and insurance. How the heck did that happen? Who got that? Who got you to do that?
My insurance agent. I actually end up working with Missouri Farm Bureau as a customer and still am. But I met, you know, an agent at the gym working out, you know, which has been another big passion in my life, and just started talking to him and the way he approached it was kind of like what you were talking about with me with networking, and right, kind of sit back and wait and evaluate, and then there's a conversation. Then eventually, it's like, hey, what do you do? And then it's very unassuming, right? And that's the way he was, and that's part of the reason why he's still my agent today. I could probably go find, you know, lesser expensive coverage, but I know he's got me if I ever have a problem. So that's worth the weight in gold that I pay them. But yeah, so a lady named Curio was my sales trainer there in Jeff City, and or not her sales, but she's my trainer anyway. And eventually, you know, years later, she comes back around after a couple other positions that I'll talk about here in a minute, and asked me if I was ever thought about being a coach. But before that, I got a little more sales and marketing experience and helped. I went back to a previous company, the two-way radio company, and helped them launch a Shopify site and got into e-commerce and learned a lot about sales and marketing and did a lot of trade shows where I got to stand in front of people and talk and sell, which I found that I liked a lot more, which is to tie back into today, which is why I like networking so much. You know, I don't have any problem talking and standing in front of somebody and starting a conversation. And so that's, to me, is invigorating. It fills my cup up. It's fun. So I got to do a lot of that with them. I got to kind of work the numbers behind the scenes. If you do this kind of input, what does that result as far as sales online? When we discount this much, that equals this. And it was very, you could see where changes, you know, could really make a difference. And you could try things because it was a small, nimble enough company. You could try things and without a whole lot of cost and see results. And so that was, it was frustrating because we didn't have the budget we wanted to do stuff sometimes, but invigorating because it was like you got to, you know, it's like building, it's like playing SimCity.
You know,
you get to turn knobs and push buttons and rotate things and slide, move a slider here or there and see the results. And so that was a lot of fun, but that led me to Avadam Health, which is probably, again, you know, as we get older and smarter and wiser and work through business, we get better at things. That was probably my biggest win of my career to date. And partly because of 2020, partly because, you know, we were telling the management of something to do and they just didn't want to take action until they were almost forced. So kind of that blockbuster chain. So I'm working, I get hired by a friend of mine. Again, it's not what you know, it's who you know. Got hired by a friend of mine to do e-commerce manager for Avadam Health. That job entailed basically everything e-commerce. I'm responsible for, I would say a lot of the marketing, but not just what's being put in place in the marketing, but not necessarily the marketing message, et cetera. We had teams for that, right? So now I'm at the point where I've got other people that are doing a lot of the things. I'm just kind of not in charge per se, but I've got some more help. And working through understanding how and what to put on eBay, Amazon, through the website. You know, the company sold stuff in Walmart and CVS and Walgreens, all the big retailers. So without competing against ourselves at the same time, you know, Walmart.com is coming online at this time, you know, so lots of things are changing as far as e-commerce landscape. Third parties are trying to basically buy our stuff off the back of a truck someplace and resell online. We got to worry about third parties trying to undercut us. I mean, there's so much going on. But the beauty that happened in 2020 is when everything shut down, that meant all the retail shut down. So we've been trying to convince management to try to put more stuff on Amazon, eBay, et cetera, for years. So this is 2018, 2019, going into the first part of 2020. And they're like, no. Retail's the way to go. It's where we make most of our money, blah, blah. Hindsight being 2020, when I left Avadam in 23, we were the e-commerce, the Amazon side specifically, was second only to Walmart retail. So we went from a couple hundred thousand dollars a month in basically almost restricted sales. They didn't want us to sell anything. We were just kind of a thorn in their side, but we were there partly because we did the marketing for the rest of the company. But about $6.5 million. That was a fun ride to be a part of.
Why did you make that shift?
Make the shift from
the next one. Yeah. So from that, you said it was a fun ride. Why'd you get off it?
I was voluntarily let go. I was laid off.
Yeah.
So over the course of this process, this company had gone bankrupt.
Really?
And
wait a minute now.
Yep.
Sounded very successful there a second ago.
Well, success is one thing, but when you were, you know, it's like a lot of startups. You hemorrhage money for a long time before you finally become successful, or you don't, and that's just the end of it. The door's closed. No, successful, very successful, but also hemorrhaging from the early days. And hemorrhaging to the point of uh-oh. So, but here's the key. Here's the real kicker. This is where 2020 is a kick in the shorts as much as it is a boon for the business. So it's February 2021, or 2020. The stock market has not yet closed, but it's about to. This company is on the stock market floor to go public, looking to an influx of $50 to $100 million in spendable capital. Stock market closes the week before it's supposed to go public. Therefore, bankruptcy ensues a year later. Now, when you think about companies, what's one of their biggest expenses?
People.
Yep. So if you are owned by a private equity company, the number one thing they want to get off their books is expenses, because that makes the company look more liquid. So in doing that, a lot of the really good people that we had in that digital marketing team and the company wide were let go or third-partied or whatever, right? So because they, by paying a subscription or a monthly fee for a service, it looks like just an expense on the books that's a short term versus an employee's salary, which they look at more of a long term. So a lot of us were third-partied, and my position was one of them. My position got absorbed by three people and the third party that they offloaded to.
Yeah. Yeah. To your point about biggest expense, for some reason, my mind went to a quote from Felix Dennis, How to Get Rich. He says, overhead walks on two legs. And so it's an interesting read for anybody that wants it, partly because I think he probably wasn't the nicest person to work for. But or maybe it's just where he's at in life. He's very direct, very, very, very direct. But he's also the type of person that, like, in his mind, you're comfortably poor if you're under 10 million. His assistants had assistants because they just couldn't keep up with the call flow. He's like, I had assistants, and then I had to have my assistants have my assistants. And then, but then, you know, he'd still meet with people regularly, just floor people. So I don't know. Hard to say. It's the kind of person that says overhead walks on two legs.
Yep. So that
interesting.
That resulted in, you know, my acquaintance Carrie reaching out to me and saying, "Hey, you ever thought about coaching?" I'm like, "I'm not a coach. Are you crazy?" You know, I mean, we're talking about like fourth, fifth, sixth grade boys basketball that I coached for a little while. Yeah, I've done that, but I've never coached anybody. And she was like, "Well, you know, tell me about a time when you trained somebody to do X." Yep. Okay. Tell me about a time.
She did the same thing you did.
Yeah. Well, she's a coach. Go figure.
It's pretty good. Right? It's pretty good.
She started using all the questions on me that I use today. Yeah. You've heard me use on you.
Tell me about a time.
Like, tell me about a time when. And suddenly I looked at her like, okay, so I've been coaching for all this time, but I just called it something different. Right. You know, and being a lifelong learner and her telling me about all the different, you know, things that Southwestern had. I mean, their training program, if you had to buy it outright, they estimated at $30,000 in materials, you know? So I was like, I get to learn all this stuff and I get to coach people and, oh yeah, I got to sell some stuff, but you know, that'll be okay. 'Cause you know, it's servant selling. It'll be fun. yeah, this, you know, sure, let's go. So that was December of 2023.
It's exciting.
Almost 2 years later.
I relate to exactly what you're talking about. Showing up in person with a conversation is there's something completely different than that and over the phone. So I feel like we should start to move to wrap up. The first thing is, did we really miss anything? You know, I mean, there was a lot of growth moments in there. Like, okay, one thing, okay, before we do move to wrap up, just pre-warning, I guess. What was it like to lose that position? Can you kind of walk me through that? Because you sounded like
let's put it this way. Here's how, and I will say that the Lord works in mysterious ways.
Okay? Yeah, amen to that.
So this is a Tuesday before the Labor Day holiday. Okay. A week from that Friday, so in less than 2 weeks, I'm to sign the loan paperwork to start building on a new home that we had purchased land for. So needless to say, that home didn't get built. But luckily, you know, again, thank whoever you believe in, but thank God that we didn't sign that paperwork and get started on that. And then 6 months in go, uh-oh. Because, you know, we very well could have been, I wouldn't say bankrupt, but we could have been in very, very, very big financial trouble very, very quickly, you know? So in preparation for this, we had sold our house and moved, you know, to basically, you know, rent effectively.
Yeah.
You know, tried to eliminate as much debt as we could in order to be able to afford to go into the building process. We had built before, so it wasn't like it wasn't scary. And of course, selling our house, we had a pretty good chunk of equity after living there for 17 years. So, I mean, it wasn't as financially daunting as I make it out to be. That's not the case. But then going from having a significant income to having none. And I mean, after being there for 5 years, a severance of that was basically a pittance, was frustrating.
When you're about to go into building, so it looks like in the onset at the time, it looks like you're flipping everything, personal and professional. It's all coming crashing down a little bit.
Yeah. Hey, you want to talk about a guy who didn't feel like he had a whole lot of self-worth for a little while, falling in the woes of your own self-pity, you know, because you've got no job, you've got no income. Now the dreams of building the house are on hold for who knows how long, maybe forever. Right. To then be luckily picked up by a former coworker that says, hey, you really could be good at this if you give yourself the chance.
Yeah. We're all a few whoopsie daisies from becoming couch potatoes really fast, aren't we? Just a little bit wallowing in our own self-pity.
Yep. Bag of Cheetos and a cold beverage and watching Wapner Hour.
Mine was on the computer. My wife had to look in one day. I think I did about 2 months worth, 2-3 months worth before my wife was like, and maybe I exaggerated, I don't know, but it was long. And the wake up call was my wife like, you're going to go back to a job or get out of the house, get out of the house isn't like go do like the 9-to-5, or are you going to do the thing that you're supposed to be doing?
Like, yep.
Oh, well, shoot.
Yep. It's a tough moment, but that's, those things happen, and everything, you know, I'm a firm believer, everything happens for a reason. So, you know, sometimes we don't always know what the reasons are and gosh, can they be frustrating or challenging, but you know, just, you know, when change happens, just kind of embrace the change and try to figure out, okay, if you keep asking yourself what's next, you'll never just sit there and wallow in your own self pity. You don't have time.
When I'm finally kind of at this point where I'm thankful, and hopefully I keep this up more in the moment, because the truth of the matter is the things you learn, for me, the most impactful lessons have come sometimes in the more difficult packages.
Well, and that's been throughout the dawn of time, right? You know, yeah. We learn how to do things because we failed at something else. You know, we couldn't figure out that the wagon wasn't great. So we figure out how to make a car.
Yeah.
You know, the sleeping in a tent under the stars is awesome. But when there's bears that want to eat you, maybe something with a little more structure is a better idea. Right.
Right.
You know, we learn things from failure. We have the Black Plague. Well, guess what? We shouldn't put all of our poo in the street. We should probably create a septic system. You know,
right.
We learn these things kind of the hard way sometimes. And it's not because we could prevent things. It's just the way things naturally happen.
Have we talked about that? That wiped out like half of Europe. That is wild to me. Wild. This, yep. I mean, we think about, you know, that's what I was researching for my COVID project was like just a little bit of the Black Plague. Because you look at the death toll and, you know, at the time we were making a big deal. We were making a big deal out of COVID. I think somebody even maybe compared it to the Black Plague once or twice. And so that's when I bothered to like, well, okay, what was the death toll for the Black Plague? No, half of Europe, half of multiple countries dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a plague.
Yeah.
So we have two questions we like to ask towards the end here. So we start to kind of wrap up. So we have an old saying here and it goes, if we have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. Who's been a giant in your life that you'd like to pay homage to in this moment?
Man, there's been a lot of them. And to pay homage to one is probably disrespecting all of them, you know, as much as I hate to say that. But I would say that, you know, I'll go back to, my parents, right? They're the people that instilled the work ethic that I have, which again, to me is always a little, I could always improve in that area, right? They instilled to me the morals and values that I stand upon today. I mean, if somebody's going to call me names or bully me around, I don't need that person in my life. It just happened very recently. And I'm like, no. I can be friends with somebody and still have differing opinions, and I'm okay with that. But if you're going to call me names because of it, you can go, right? Those are the kind of things that were instilled in me a long, 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 long time ago and as I grew up. So I would say, you know, parents first, and then there's more people that I can count that have poured into me over the years. Whether it's be, you know, coaches that I had in school, coaches that I have now. You know, through business, you know, my coach now, Anthony Merkel, Carrie, my previous coach, right? Those people poured into me more than I can possibly imagine and still are to this day. So those are the big ones. Of course, you know, I've been married for 27 years, so I look around because my wife's desk behind me, but, you know, so she's poured into me over the years too. So I'd be amiss. And probably sleeping on the couch permanently if I didn't mention, you know, her as well. So hopefully she says the same about me.
That's good. What's been kind of a guiding principle or rule of thumb you found to be true again and again and again?
Help people.
This would be one of those pithy sayings, help people.
Yep. Just, you know, when people depend on you, help them. You know, when people don't depend on you, but you find somebody in need, you know, if you can, don't put yourself in a place where you're in danger, but help them. You know, if you pull up and see somebody about ready to jump off a bridge, that may not be your strong suit, but at least pick up the phone and call 911 and say, this is what I saw, right? And that may not be the help that you personally can provide, but you have provided some help. So it doesn't have to be a direct interaction. It can just be something that's almost unseen or unheard. That's in the background that you don't need any recognition for, but, you know, you tried to have, provide some.
Tim, thank you so much for joining me today.
Appreciate you having me. Every time we have these conversations, whether it's here or someplace else, I feel like we always go to another level. So you stir things in me that I didn't know existed sometimes. So that's good.
Good, 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 good. Thank you. Well, with that, I'd say, bye, everybody.
Hello, everyone. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.